This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
And good evening to everybody. This is Lefty Pinkos on Joy 94.9. I'm joined tonight by Patrick.
Hello, Emma. Lovely to be here as always.
It is nice to be here. As everyone's aware, last Saturday was Anzac Day. If you're not aware, you've been asleep for the weekend.
I've been asleep for a long time beforehand, too.
True. A day in the year when people acknowledge in some way those who've served in the various conflicts in our history. Every year, I must admit I get a bit confused about the messages being delivered around Anzac Day, the Gallipoli campaign, and in modern times, the importance that Gallipoli takes on as a place. It's the annual Australian and New Zealand invasion of the Gallipoli Peninsula that probably has a bit to do with that. I also wonder just how the respect and remembrance is translated into how we utilise our defence forces in conflicts and see to their welfare on their return. To help me in my confusion, I hope, we're joined tonight by John Blaxland from Canberra. Now, John, I hope you'll forgive me for this, but I took this from the internet, so it is correct, as we're aware. John's currently a senior fellow at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at ANU, who writes about military history, intelligence and security, and Asia-Pacific affairs. He holds a PhD in War Studies from the Royal Military College of Canada, an MA in History from the ANU, a BA from the University of New South Wales, and is a graduate of the Royal Thai Army Command and Staff College. I'm sure there's more. Amazing CV, and I hope it's correct, John.
You got it right so far, Emma. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
I'm going to start, and I'm not sure if it's just me, but there appear to be multiple elements to Anzac Day, such that when you get call out an aspect of the day that isn't quite right in your mind, everyone else jumps on that criticism, although you've committed some sacrilegious act. Examples of these elements are the nation-building events that apparently started at Gallipoli. We didn't have a nation built before that, apparently. Remembering those who have fallen and served, and also perhaps the element that I don't see as much, but people have comment about, is the glorification of war.
It's very interesting, you know, the whole idea of nation-building. Australia, we had a peaceful federation, and you know, in some respects, we can blame the Brits from this because they learned from the experience of the American Revolutionary War. They realised that if they actually wanted their colonies to remain moderately loyal, they had to give them some concessions. And 90 years after the Revolutionary War, the War of Independence, Canada became a federation in 1867, peacefully as well. And a generation later, Australia became a federation in 1901. But of course, as you know, that was a fairly uneventful event, if you like. You know, kind of nothing dramatic happened. There wasn't a storming of the Bastille. There wasn't a bombs bursting in air as you get in the US national anthem. There was no dramatic moment of pathos that people could identify as being the point at which Australia became Australia. And I think the setting of Gallipoli, particularly in light of the kind of romantic education that many people had about Greek tragedy, about the ancient Greeks and the Turks and the battles that were written about by people like Herodotus and Thucydides that took place in the Aegean and around the Aegean Sea, there was a sense that maybe this was Australia's moment. And certainly the journalists, the British journalists, Australian journalists who wrote about it, particularly C.W. Bean, really, I think, picked up on that and just went with it. And there was a very receptive audience in Australia. There was an audience that really wanted to latch onto this moment of apparent greatness. And so when the cables came back with news of what was happening, even though it was a tragedy on one level. There was a sense of glory that, you know, when you're only reading the sanitized version from the newspapers weeks afterwards, sparked remarkable enthusiasm for what had happened. And it wasn't until much later that people cottoned on to just how severe it was and how consequential it was. And then it took on a new meaning as this kind of moment. Well, we've got to have a sense of meaning. It's got to have some meaning. People can't just die for nothing. You know, it's got to have some special meaning, doesn't it? And so I think we latched onto it from that point of view. And so it really, you know, took on a nation-building character that there was a really, you know, even though people can say, oh, C.W. Benn concocted it, and others did as well, the bottom line is that Australians really were very receptive to it. And so, yes, it was nation-building in a sense. It was mythology-building, if you like. And we all kind of lapped it up. That's how it was, you know.
I can't help but you use the term glory, and I can't help to be reminded of the war poem by Wilfred Owen, Dulce est decorum est pro patri mori, which really, you know, what was it? It was it is good and noble to die to die for one's country, and exactly. I suppose that's that was latched on early during that time, and now there's there is obviously a reverence and a remembrance, but there's this sort of underlying current that you're starting to see where it is good to die for one's country, especially in this scenario, and then creating this nation out of there, which I also think is kind of ridiculous because that's assuming that Australia, the Australian nation, has only ever been validated by the colonists, the invaders of white extraction, when we've had a lot of, and especially this was very good for Anzac Day, this year around I saw a lot of push for the Indigenous soldiers and those who served whilst not even being recognised as humans, let alone citizens.
Yeah, no, you're right. No, it's a big issue. I don't think we as a nation have quite resolved yet.
There's a lot of things in there. Sorry, I don't want to just drop that bomb on there, but there is a lot. There is a lot to go on there. But
there is.
It is quite interesting to look at that kind of that underlying current sort of coming back. Emma,
John, you talk about the Australian public getting this reasonably sanitised version. Did that fervour continue, or did it lapse a little bit after the war when just the sheer scale of the tragedy of the Great War was beginning to be understood?
Yeah, no, well, when returned soldiers were seen around the streets, when veterans came home, when wounded were sent home, unable to be redeployed on in battle, people started to realise just how horrific it was when people came back without limbs, some people without parts of their face, some people just completely disfigured for life. People began to have a sense of how horrific it was. And when the cable came back of loved ones lost, have died in action, the grief began and it would continue for at least a generation. But the grieving actually took place probably as much, if not more, amongst the families of those who returned with what we then called shell shock, but which today we would call post-traumatic stress disorder, of which a large fraction committed suicide at some point or other after the war. Rick Throssell, the Victoria Cross winner, is a classic example. You know, came back a hero and yet couldn't live with himself, with the pictures in his mind that were just completely unsettling, to the point where he just couldn't cope anymore. And he's just one of many, many thousands of Australians who returned unable to cope with the haunting memories of what they had been through, and then not being able to grapple with it because society didn't recognise it for what it was. And look, even today we still face that problem with our soldiers, sailors and their men and women returning from operations in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and in East Timor as well, where people are really struggling, even though there's a there are systems in place, there are mechanisms in place to help people recognise it. And I remember myself coming back from operations in East Timor at the end of 99. I was debriefed by a counsellor, and it was like, oh, well, we've ticked that box now. You know, he's been debriefed. It's all good. Now, I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm relatively, you know, questionably sane. but, you know, a lot of people are really, really traumatised and actually don't recognise it in themselves. And it's only when their lives start to unravel that it becomes at all apparent. And when those in their immediate family are directly affected, that the penny starts to drop. But often that's too late, because by then they're in a vicious spiral of, you know, self destructive behaviour that's hard to break out of.
And that's not necessarily just when we're going for active service, is it? It's our peacekeepers as well see some very horrendous things.
And one of the things that happens now when Australians get ready to deploy, part of the training is to actually get people to avoid seeing blood and gore, avoid overexposure to carnage, if at all possible, because of the recognition that once you go and help somebody who might be bleeding all over the floor or the ground, you'll never, ever get that picture out of your head. Mm. And that is haunting. And that is a picture that, you know, emergency services people in, not in the military, but in the police and the emergency services of Australia grapple with as well. So there's an issue beyond the military. But in terms of those, as you say, who go on peacekeeping operations, or, you know, East Timor was supposed to be peacekeeping, peace enforcement. Many people came back from that just very, finding it very hard to cope with what they saw. The harrowing scenes that just have haunted them for 15 years. And we're seeing that, I think, probably on an even greater scale now with our soldiers who've been on multiple deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly those who were heavily involved in combat operations, those who saw, you know, somebody shot and killed or blown up by an IED, or even just blasted and damaged by IED being improvised explosive device or kind of a mine or something like that. It's really the after effects, the aftershocks, much greater than the raw statistics that you get from, you know, the official records really show.
You're on Lefty Pinkos with Emma and Patrick. We are speaking with John Blaxland, who is the Senior Fellow at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU. Thank you again for joining us, John. It's been already very, very insightful.
My pleasure, Patrick.
Now, Emma, you were about to jump into when people critique some of the more, I suppose, unsettling aspects that could come about when we celebrate or remember Anzac Day.
Yes, well, John, we had a couple of examples over the weekend, and I'm as much as I think people should be allowed to comment about these days, and we should, probably shouldn't be so precious about them, I think the way it was done in both instances left a lot to be desired. The first one was an article in one of the print media, I think it was, comparing soldiers who had volunteered to serve in the expeditionary force that went to Gallipoli, comparing them with people who are volunteering to fight with ISIS.
Yeah.
Now, it seems a pretty distasteful comparison and seems to be ignoring the fact that in the first case, the government was involved and agreed. And the second case is arguably terrorism. And so I can't quite make the connection. But a pretty unfortunate way of expressing a view around the political moves that made the Gallipoli campaign probably appear quite worthless in retrospect. The second one was, of course, the SBS journalist who was tweeting things during Anzac Day, which also seemed to be a pretty naive thing to expect that you wouldn't get the reaction he got. But I guess this is one of the sensitivities that when someone does take a bit of a crack at a pretty important day in the year for a lot of Australians, in fact, I'd say for the majority of Australians, it needs to be done reasonably sensitively. And if you are going to single out the political nature and probably trying to draw some sort of view around Gallipoli as not being, you know, a particularly successful nation-building start. But that aside, you need to be very, very careful and I think a hell of a lot smarter than we saw.
Yeah, no, you're making some good points there, Emma. It's very interesting when you think about what was at play at Gallipoli and what's at play with what I would call the Daeshists, the so-called ISIS, yeah. The so-called Islamic State.
Yeah.
You know, people readily dismiss what happened in the First World War as completely meaningless, as completely in vain. But, you know, that's such a historical nonsense, in my view. You can't just translate that view 100 years ago and say that that's what they should have done back then. In 1915, Australia wasn't an independent nation. Australia was an integral part of the British Empire. The idea of Australia being an independent nation that made its own decisions about its foreign and defence policy just was a nonsense back then. Australia's trade was almost exclusively with Britain. It went through the Suez Canal. It was completely reliant on that canal remaining open. It was completely reliant on Britain winning. The notion that it was going to be okay to let Germany, which by then, at that stage, still controlled New Guinea, which is just north of the Australian territory of Papua, and various other territories in the Pacific, and had a fleet in the Pacific, that it was going to be okay and just let them not worry about it too much. It's just detached from reality. The bottom line is Australia didn't have a choice in 1914 about what it was going to do. The only choice it had was how many troops it was going to send. And even then, it didn't force anybody. It was all voluntary. So, you know, I think we need to just keep things in perspective on that. And it was, the sense was back then that this was the just cause, that Germany had invaded Belgium, had invaded France. It needed to be checked. You know, it's hard to argue with that. You know, there were factors behind it that are a bit murky, but that's what actually happened. Germany invaded Belgium and France. And they would have done more if they hadn't been stopped. So the comparison, though, with Daeshists, I would say, is it's an odious one, really. This is not a nation state. This is not an organisation that deserves to be called a state, which is why I call it the so-called Islamic State or the Daeshists, because they really do not deserve the honour of being recognised as a state. And no state in that area, none of the co-religionist Sunni states recognise it as a state, nor do the Shia states such as Iran recognise it as a state. So I'm blowed if I know why we should recognise it as a state. And then you go to what kind of motives somebody has for wanting to join a group like ISIS or declare that it is somehow equally noble or ignoble as Australia's voluntary contribution to fight against German imperialism. And you have to wonder just what they've been smoking or drinking, because the list is so long.
And you make a point too that we were dependent, Australia and New Zealand were dependent on the Suez Canal, and both countries expended a lot of effort and a lot of manpower in other parts of the Middle East, not just the Aegean, and often with success, often without. And that aspect is often ignored. Palestine was a huge focus.
It was a huge focus. And this is actually an interesting segue to the issue of glorification we touched on at the start. When you think about what Australia did under General Sir Harry Chevelle, the Australian commander, who was the Middle Eastern counterpart to Sir John Monash, who fought so valiantly in the Western Front in France and Flanders in 1617-18 up there. Sir Harry Chevelle gets a lot of glory for, you know, the Australian light horse, the mounted Australian, the Anzac mounted infantry, the work that was done at the Battle of Beersheba that broke through the Turkish line, the capture of Jerusalem and Damascus, Now, you know, there's some really very clever and engaging writers, I would call them historical authors, who really take a lot of liberties with the truth. And they talk in a very jingoistic way about how Australia almost single-handedly won the war. And, you know, it's just got rocks in it. That kind of thinking is just so banal, because Australia was a bit player in a much bigger imperial inter-imperial war. The idea that Sir Harry, won it single-handedly in Palestine, and Sir John Monash won it single-handedly in Europe, it's incredibly myopic thinking. The efforts of Sir John Monash and the Australian Corps on the Western Front I'm not at all trying to take away from it. It was outstanding. But so was the work of the Canadian Corps. So was the work of the French Corps alongside and the British Corps and the Americans as well. They were all fighting at the peak of their performance in 1918. So let's keep things in perspective. And as far as Sir Harry Chevelle, look, there's no question the bravery was amazing, extraordinary valour. But it wasn't. They weren't the only ones being brave. We weren't the only ones. Yes. You know, the charge at Beersheba was fantastic, and it was miraculous they weren't all killed, thanks to the miscalculation of the gunners, the Turkish machine gunners, and artillery fire. But the bottom line is that couldn't have happened had the rest of the British Expeditionary Force there been holding the rest of the line. So we just need to. There's a sense, I'm probably going to get pilloried for daring to touch on, this notion of how great Australians were at Anzac and how great the Anzacs were in the First World War. Well, there's no question they were good, but they took a long while to get good, and they took a lot of training, and there were others, as I say, from other countries who performed equally valiantly and professionally by 1918. So... sorry to disappoint, but we're not that outstanding. Yes, we're good, but I think it gets back to an issue which speaks to the whole question about why Gallipoli matters so much. If you're thinking back 100 years ago now, most people had some connection with convicts back then, particularly from the eastern states. There was a recognition that we had a less than glorious beginning, shall we say, and there was a sense that we needed to have some kind of moment of glory, moment of being equal, if not better, than the British, the English, the Scots, the Welsh, the others, the Irish, who had not been transported as convicts to Australia. Somehow we needed to show them somehow. Mother England had to be shown that we were worthy of being let out of those chains.
John, we've run out of time, and unfortunately we can't get to talk about the Australian flag.
We'll have to talk about this again.
Be another time.
I definitely think that there is a lot more that we can unpack in here. Thank you very much for your time, John. We really appreciate it, and thank you for your insight and your wisdom. Much appreciated.
Pleasure, Patrick.
Thank you. You are on Lefty Pinkos here on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.